Hello, and welcome to episode 102 for Speak Beastie for December 15th, 2019. I'm Lizzie.
I'm Helene, and we have a guest host with us this week.
Woo!
Want to introduce yourself?
Hey, y'all. Michael's back.
He's back, baby!
Just for a hot second, but only because these ladies flattered me, and flattery works really well because I'm very narcissistic. So here I am to give my opinion.
So that should put everyone in a really good mood for today's episode. That's all you need to know.
but seriously, though, y'all, thank you for asking me to be on this episode. I after leaving the podcast, my thoughts on Potter are still aplenty, and there's been so much buzz, especially around Fantastic Beasts, and so I'm excited to pop back in for a full show. It was really fun coming back for the 100th episode, so it'll be fun to dive into a little deeper into some discussion today.
Yeah, we were
listening.
We recorded for that 100 episode together too. So this is my second time recording with you, which is crazy because I'd never talked to you before.
I know. We didn't get to record very much together. So, and Helene, you had joined by the time that I was still on, but we never recorded while you had joined, right?
I don't think so. I think I joined after you left.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
But
we didn't really have any overlap or anything. It was
No. So, well, good. We'll fix that now.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Excellent.
Woo! I am awkward. All right. It's been a long day.
It's been a long week. I am awkward.
Yeah. See, I hate doing the Phoenix Register because every time I say it, I feel like I'm trying to impersonate Ariel, but I'm not. I'm just trying to say it. But I'm so used to everyone trying to impersonate her that I just feel like I am. All right.
You can do this. I have faith.
Thank you. So much faith. All right. And now it's time for the Phoenix Register.
And now a message from our sponsors. Hey you! Yes you! The magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind the scenes features. But wait, there's more! Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wiggs Knees and How.
Not much news, but there is something exciting. The Magical Time of Year album has come out in support of Lumos. And this is a nice, like, 13-track album with your favorite Potter and Fantastic Beast people, and even some Cursed Child alumni. Everyone just got together and recorded their own renditions of some of your favorite Christmas songs. And honestly, it is my Christmas soundtrack this year. I don't know about any of you guys.
I gotta say, when they announced this, I thought it was a joke. Like, I thought that they were, like, kidding. I didn't think that they were actually going to make a Christmas album. And when it came out, I was like, holy crap, they did it.
Well, also, they started talking about this a year ago?
Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago. For this to finally have come out, it feels... It's almost like that Harry Potter encyclopedia that J.K. Rowling talked about once, and I'm still holding out hope for. It's fine. But if you want to... If you're not interested in listening to the full album, but you want to hear some of your favorite Fantastic Beasts people, on track two, we have Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow with Claudia Kim, who plays Nagini. Track three is It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas with the surprise standout of Kevin Guthrie, who plays Abernathy. Who would have seen it coming? Not me. Track five is Hanukkah, Oh Hanukkah with Dan Fogler and Ezra Miller. What a gem that one is.
That one's my personal favorite.
It's a good one. On track eight, we have Santa Baby by Pavi Corby Tuish, who is just on our last episode. So thank you for joining us again. She, of course, plays Rosier. Track 10 is Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas with Allison Sudol. Track 12, we have O Come, O Come, Emmanuel with William Nadalam, who plays Yusuf Kama, also recently on our show. Feels so special. I didn't realize just how lucky we are to have had so many wonderful guests in this past year.
Shout out to Megan for getting them. Yeah, yep.
Yeah. And then track 13, O Holy Night with Ezra Miller. So most of this album is basically Fantastic Beasts people, which is really cool. And they're all extremely talented. Of course, you know, we know of Allison Sudol's background and Ezra Miller, and Dan Fogler as well. But the rest of them are very pleasant surprises. So definitely check it out. It is, of course, again, in support of Lumos. You can stream it or purchase it anywhere you get your albums. Yeah, so sadly, there is no owl post for this episode just because we need to keep the owls nice and safe. You know, it's too cold for owls right now. Might heat up a little bit by the time of our next episode. Well, hopefully today's main discussion will inspire you to send your owl out and we'll be able to chat more about your thoughts in the future. Because today's main discussion is actually, I'm surprised we haven't covered it already, at least more in depth like we're about to. But as we know, Steve Kloves is coming back as a screenwriter for Fantastic Beasts 3. For those who might have a slight reminder of that name, but aren't exactly just like, it's not jumping out at you. He wrote for all the Potter films except for Order of the Phoenix. And then I looked up some fun facts, and five of those scripts actually earned over $4.7 billion, so not too bad. And I found a really fun quote from the Los Angeles Times in 2006, where someone asked Kloves, "Why didn't you decide to do Order of the Phoenix?" And he responded, "You know, I don't even know why. The fourth film, Goblet of Fire, was really hard to do. I wrote on it for 2 years, but it's not that simple, and I don't know that I'll ever fully understand why I didn't do it. This will sound glib, but it's somewhat true. They asked me on the wrong day."
You know, I bet it's because, well, Goblet of Fire is like the biggest book until Order of the Phoenix, so he probably saw how hard Goblet of Fire was, realized how big Order of the Phoenix was, and thinking about having to adapt that large of a, like, novel into a 2 hour, 2.5 hour screenplay, he probably was like, "F that noise, I'm not doing that."
Apparently he regrets it. He wishes he had done it. Somewhere else he had said, like, if they had asked me again, because apparently they asked him a couple of times and he just kept saying no, and then this last no was the one they finally took the answer for. But he essentially has said, if they had asked me one more time, I would have said yes and I would have done it.
Sure.
And then some other fun facts before we really get into it that I thought were interesting is Kloves gained Rowling's trust by saying that his favorite character was Hermione. She has said, "If he got Hermione, he got the books. He also, to a large extent, got me."
So basically, if we ever meet J.K. Rowling and we want her to trust us, we just gotta say that Hermione's our favorite character.
Exactly. That's it. Problem solved. And then the most interesting fact that I found is that he hasn't written anything since The Amazing Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield in 2012.
I liked that movie, personally.
Oh, I don't have anything negative to say about it. It's just he has, from the span of 2012 to now, he just has not done any screenwriting projects.
He's living.
At least none that are listed on IMDb.
He's living off his earnings from the first, all of the Harry Potter movies, basically.
Yeah, he's like, I can retire. He's got that Potter money, apparently. And then I thought that this would be just like a nice introduction to the discussion. In that Los Angeles Times article, he had said, if people like a Harry Potter movie, it's because of the book. But if they don't like it, then it's my fault. And I just found that to be very interesting.
Sounds like he's a little bitter, to be honest.
I know. But he also was a producer on Fantastic Beasts 1 and 2. He's also listed to be a producer for Fantastic Beasts 3. So essentially today we're just going to really dive in and talk about what we think this means for the third film. You know, are we more optimistic hearing that Cloves is coming back and that, you know, Rowling is going to be, you know, directly having someone to work besides her? Are we a little nervous based on what we thought of how the Potter films turned out? All that fun stuff.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think it'll be I think a lot of people will have a lot of different opinions. I've already heard a ton of different opinions about this since the news came out. So I'm really interested to kind of dig into it and speculate a little bit about what's to come, because I think that this is interesting.
Yeah. Michael, I saw that you had some stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you want to go through it, I guess?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it, like, fits in, like, a specific place, like, in a narrative that you had.
I mean, I just added those things because I thought they were interesting pieces about maybe, like, I think the thing that's worth kind of perhaps starting the discussion with, if you'll allow me to be so bold, is that there was a determination. Okay, so this is, you have to put aside whether or not you personally liked Crimes of Grindelwald. If you liked it or you didn't like it, that's kind of irrelevant in this point of the discussion. Because what happened is that, regardless of whether you, the listener, the audience member, the Potter lover, liked Crimes of Grindelwald or not, Warner Brothers did not like what happened with Crimes of Grindelwald. They could not say so much in certain terms because...
What a shock.
There's a brand integrity issue to deal with there, but a big part of that brand integrity issue was that the brand, for probably one of the first times, was properly bashed. And not just by the audience, but in seemingly by its own creator. And it was... This is not something that's easy, I think, for Potter to handle, because it's not something that's really happened before. Basically, Fantastic Beasts was critically panned, the second installment, and it's the first Potter film to receive a rotten rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And in addition to that, while it still made money, it made a profit, there was a noticeable dip, even if that dip was not enough to affect the fact that it profited. But for a brand that's been as trustworthy as Potter all the way up until Crimes of Grindelwald, that's probably pretty frightening for Warner Brothers to see. Especially, I think the critical panning was even more of a concern. Because word of mouth, like, the strength of the Potter brand can only do so much if word of mouth is truly that negative. And if you go back and look at some of the marketing for Crimes of Grindelwald, and we actually talked about this on a previous episode of Speak Beastie, and Lizzie, I know you were kind of in the thick of this, so you saw what was happening firsthand, but Warner Brothers drastically transformed the marketing of Crimes of Grindelwald in the middle of marketing it. As the reviews came out, they were like, uh-oh, well, we can't rely on reviews, so let's turn to the fans. And there was almost this reliance on, look at this fan screening that we videotaped. They really liked it because they got to see it early. Or, ooh, look at these fans standing in King's Cross Station, and we sent Eddie Redmayne and Jude Law to them. They sure are happy. That means this is a good movie. So, but with that in mind, Warner Brothers, I think the reason that Cloves is even being brought on is because Warner Brothers had enough of an argument to say, oh, I guess we can approach J.K. Rowling and say, hey, sweetie, are you okay? Kind of. Are you okay? And I think that, like, that's why I would recommend listeners, if you haven't watched these two particular videos, I would definitely recommend taking a glance at them. One is called Fantastic Beasts, How J.K. Rowling Writes Mystery Revisited, which is on the channel Just Right, which is run by a guy named Sage Hayden, I believe his name is. Sorry, Sage, if I got your name wrong. But he does great videos about breaking down writing in film And he actually had previously done a video about how Rowling constructs a mystery in her films. And then he basically looked at the Harry Potter stories and the mystery that's constructed there. And then he looked at Fantastic Beasts and compared and contrasted the two. And in addition to that, I would also recommend another set of video or another video from Evan Pushek, I think his name is, or the Nerd Writer on YouTube. His video is called "The Epidemic of the Epidemic of Passable Movies," and Potter is not mentioned in this set of in this particular video, but I think it's relevant to the discussion about Fantastic Beasts because I do think. Something that just shocks me as a Potter fan is, and watching both, not only these films, but the fandom reaction, is that we are, I think there's almost this active training to get us to accept material that is not at the level of Harry Potter. Because I think there is an unspoken understanding that Harry Potter will not happen again. And that we are searching for the next Harry Potter. And we want it from Rowling, and she cannot possibly deliver that. That is a lot to ask of her. And so what she delivered was something that was not quite up to that standard. And for the first time, there has been a hefty amount of debate in the Potter fandom about a piece of material. Now, I'm sure a lot of you who are listening are just like, cursed child. And yes, that's also an issue. But that is an issue in a different way, because that the majority of that was not written by Rowling, at least from what we can surmise. And if you haven't checked out Cursed Child, The Journey yet, you will get even more confirmation that Rowling was very distant in that writing process and basically stepped in when asked.
Say it louder for the people in the back.
It's literally in a book, you guys. It's literally in the book about the play. But I think that's like a separate part of the conversation. Because, like, you can tie Cursed Child into this conversation, but I think it's a separate part of the conversation, not only because of Rowling's involvement, but also because it's a different medium when we're talking about film. That's a little bit different.
Yeah.
And the accessibility of film.
It's not a completely different medium because it's both, like, it's both screenplay writing rather than novel writing. Well, not, it's not screenplay for a play, but it's playwriting. And script writing. Yes. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And I think the difference more isn't so much necessarily in the writing as it is the accessibility to the audience. Because Fantastic Beasts, pretty much the majority of people of Potter fans can see it. It's easy to get access to. But Cursed Child, while Cursed Child does have a lot of vitriol against it, there is this culture that was interestingly built around it by the fandom. And I think the investors were very happy that this occurred, that the initial reaction was, ugh, this isn't Harry Potter. But the people who saw it came back to the fandom and very, very haughtily said to those who could not see it, well, if you don't see it, then you just don't get it. And that creates this
that saved Cursed Child, honestly, that entire narrative.
Yes. There's this belief that's been created in the fandom that, well, if you don't see Cursed Child on stage, then you don't understand why the story is good.
There's basically like an expectation that once you see it, your entire mindset will be changed.
Yes.
Like I had that idea going in. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like I hated the screenplay or the book, the script, and I was like, this is awful. But every single person I talked to said, this is the best thing. Once you see it, you have to see it. It'll change your mind. I heard people who also hated the play and then went to go see it and loved it. And I'm like, well, okay, then I guess I have to go see it. And I went to see it, and I gotta say, I was underwhelmed.
Same girl, same.
I mean, like, as a play, it's beautiful. It still doesn't change the fact that the plot was awful. But that's a completely different, like, this isn't a Cursed Child podcast, but
it's not.
But it's important to this discussion in that, like, that where it comes into that discussion is that idea of, you know, how the Potter fandom perceives it and how the marketing the investors treat that response by the fandom, because it was a very clever banking on the tradition of Potter that, you know, they could kind of protect that issue by being like, hashtag keep the secrets. Like, oh, don't spoil it for everybody. Don't explain to people how the effects are done, because if you explain it, then they won't have a reason to see it.
But like on the first half of your point that you brought up earlier, I honestly just, I think that Warner Brothers was basically lucky that this happened so early in the franchise, that they had such bad reception and clapback from both critics and fans in the second film. I think they're lucky that that happened so early in the series, because it gives them a chance to kind of redeem it. And I think that the way that they're going about it is, you know, they were like, oh, the Potter series was so successful. Not only the books, but the films were also, I mean, overall, they were successful. There are critics of all of the films, but overall, people love the films. And I think that their way of redeeming it is saying like, oh, well, these films were successful. This guy wrote most of them. If we can bring him back, there might be a sense of nostalgia, or he might be able to save it. So I think that's the main reasoning for them bringing Cloves back, because I think that they want to bank off of past success, I guess.
I completely agree.
Yeah, I think the thing to be encouraged by with Cloves, I think it's funny to think that there would be any like lack of assurance with him being brought on. I think like I really haven't heard much except like positive things about bringing Cloves back, and I think for me, the reason it's, like, really not a problem at all is because he's not working with adaptation material. This is not an adaptation. He's working with original material that's pretty much all just currently, as far as we're aware, floating around in Rowling's head and has not been properly committed down to paper.
But isn't that something that we should possibly be concerned by, too? Because he's been successful so far adapting source material. He's had a very, very large amount of source material to work with. And now I feel like he has a smaller pool of information to draw from. So maybe it will be different.
I think that's kind of dependent on how, like, it maybe if one is familiar with Cloves' other work and how one feels about that, in addition to knowing that he has at least a more expertise in this than Rowling does. I love Rowling, and you can love Rowling and not like things that she does. And I love her and I hate her as a screenwriter. She's a terrible screenwriter. Sorry, y'all. She's not good at it. And I think the thing is at this point, I think she knows that. And it's kind of funny that she was even thrown into this in the deep end the way she was, because long ago, because they approached her about doing the screenplays for Harry Potter, and she was immediately like, no. Like, also, I'm really busy right now, you know, writing these Harry Potter novels, but also, no. Like, I don't know how to do that. And, it's you not know, it, no. And it's, you know, just because she is a very prolific youth author,
storyteller.
That does not mean that she has the gift of knowing how to write a screenplay. It's a very different medium from writing a book, I would say.
Right. I feel like we have to go back to that original thought process of, if you trust J.K. Rowling as a storyteller, someone who can create wonderful stories and has a great mind for twists and turns and, you know, things that are you think are throwaways, but they come back later, and she's able to properly explain the rest of this story to Cloves, who has been successful in taking essentially her world and putting it on film, then we should be in a better place.
I think that the biggest criticism of Cloves being brought back, because, I mean, Michael, you said all the feedback you've heard so far is positive about Cloves coming back. I've heard some negative feedback personally, and I think all of it really is rooted in the fact that not everybody loves the Harry Potter movies. Not everybody thinks that they were adapted perfectly. There are tons of, like, the sixth Harry Potter movie is, I mean, as a movie itself, it's fine, but it changed and left out so much. Like, there are things that I love and hate about all the movies, and there are a lot of people who have very, very negative thoughts and reactions to a lot of the movies because of things that he either changed or took out or added in, like in the sixth book when they burned down the borough, stuff like that. And I'm not saying that this is all Cloves. Like, obviously, there are other people and other decisions that go into this process. Like, he didn't make every single decision about what was going to be added or left out or changed. But since he was credited as the screenwriter for six or seven out of the eight films, it's, if you don't like the films, a lot of that could be attributed to him.
Yeah, I
that is true.
I get that concern, I think, from kind of a viewer standpoint. But I actually think it's a little unfounded in that you, and, you know, listeners, if you've never read Harry Potter page to screen or watched the 8-part documentary, of which I am still going through myself, I highly recommend you do, because it really enlightens the filmmaking process of Harry Potter and addresses your concerns, the common concerns that come up about the Potter adaptations. And I think one of the biggest things to remember is that poor Cloves was working with, you know, the thing about working with Rowling is that in that particular scenario, she had all of these secrets, and Cloves was the person she could tell probably the most secrets to in collaboration with, but she still couldn't tell him everything, or at least she chose not to. And by doing that, she hid information from him that was vital to building a mystery as elaborate as she does with her books. And so without all of the essentials, Cloves was kind of just guessing a lot of the time about what was going to be important. And in the end, I think you can see that he is doing some hasty patchwork in Deathly Hallows to fix it, especially in part two.
Yeah,
because he just wasn't given the right information. And I think, and you know, we've talked before on Alohomora that the Harry Potter films would have greatly benefited in that way from all seven of them being finished before the movies had become a thing, because he would have known all
that's
those
why like a remake or you know, new movies would definitely benefit from having that. Like, literally the entire fandom has been picked apart to every little piece. Like, there's so much information and there's no mystery left of what's going to happen that I feel like they could definitely include a lot more detail if they redid them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that goes back to the video of the how J.K. Rowling writes Mystery Revisited. Because a lot of that, in that video, Sage breaks down what Rowling's process is. And a big part of that, if you look at it, is that the way that Sage puts it is that the mysteries of Harry Potter are considered fair game, where while they are simultaneously complex. So she gives you enough clues that you can solve it, but it's very unlikely that you're going to solve it. Like, oh yeah, the rat did it. Like, that's not going to be something that you think of when you're reading Prisoner of Azkaban, because Rowling is really good at making her characters like Pettigrew or Ginny or Quirrell hidden culprits. She puts them in the background and only gives them mention just as a kind of background set piece, not as something that's part of the main narrative. So
I'm really interested to see how that plays into Fantastic Beasts then.
Well, the funny thing is she tried with the first one and she kind of failed, because the video addresses that, because Credence, I think she meant to mute Credence, because she kind of literally muted him, because really in the first movie he doesn't talk very much, but she didn't the part that she couldn't think of as a screenwriter, because she doesn't write that way, is she couldn't visually mute him. So she put him in every scene. And she tried to mute him additionally by having Modesty around, but she didn't do anything with Modesty visually and enough to mute Credence. So it's pretty easy to note that even if you don't maybe figure out that Credence is the obscurial, you can probably figure out that Credence is important somehow. And the same, I would say, goes for Graves or Grindelwald, because, like, he's just a... The video, Sage's video, says this, but Graves is, like, obviously terrible throughout the entire movie. There's nothing about him that's redeemable or kind in his portrayal. He's just a mean guy throughout the whole thing. And, again, normally, I think in Rowling's narrative, that would have been muted somehow. And there are certain things about a performance that you're seeing in front of you that can be hidden by Rowling's writing. I think a great example is in Prisoner of Azkaban, when Lupin, when they're doing the Boggart scene, Lupin runs in front of Harry to stop what he thinks is Voldemort going to show up as a Boggart. And it turns, as Rowling described it, it turns into a silver orb. And everybody's like, that's weird.
Yeah, you can't do that in film.
You can't. You would, and they didn't. Like, the way Cuarón does it in the film, it's like, oh, look, it's the moon. And
why is he scared of the moon? Yeah.
Why is he scared of the moon? And you can, as a viewer, you can much more easily leap to, well, it's a magical world and he's scared of the moon. What could that be versus a book where if she hides the moon, but she gives you enough to know it's a silver orb, which you could eventually maybe figure out as the moon. And when you go back and read it, you can say, oh, well, that was fair. She gave me a clue. That she can do that much more subtly because the visuals that she's making are the ones that you, the reader, create. But in a film, there is a definite image that has to go up on the screen. And I think that's where the disconnect is that Cloves can maybe help her with.
I agree. No, I think that, I mean, that's why I think that Rowling didn't agree originally to write the screenplay, because she's like, this isn't the way that I know how to engage my audience. And I know how to do it in novel form, but I need someone who actually knows how to do it. And that's where Cloves came in. And I do think he did. Overall, I think he did a good job. So I think that it should be a good move. But I'm always very skeptical, especially because I do have some very specific gripes with some of the films.
Yeah. So let's get into those. Because I'm going to keep pulling from this Los Angeles, LA Times interview a lot because I just found it really interesting. But the reporter had asked Cloves, do you work with Rowling when you're hammering out a script, or do you have total freedom to adapt as you please? Which now in hindsight is a very interesting question. To which he said, I'm a little too free. Jo's become a really good friend, one of my best friends, and I wish I had more of her. When I first got to know Jo, she wasn't married, and now she is married and has kids, so she's gotten a much bigger life. Now, we mostly correspond through email, and she's very responsive and very helpful, but from the beginning, she has always told me, I know the movies will be very different, I know they can't be the books, and I don't want them to be the books. The only thing that matters to me is that you stay true to the characters. So that's always been the one thing I feel very much in charge of, protecting the characters, and it's the thing that upsets me the most when I feel the characters are being violated. That's when I push back hard. And Helene, you immediately became upset when I put this in the doc.
Because, okay, I will start off by saying that he does do a lot of the characters justice. Like Harry, I think he does justice. I think he does Luna justice. I think he does Hermione justice. I'm not a huge Ron fan, but I do know that movie Ron is not... It's right. Not done justice. Yeah. But I will say, two of my all-time favorite characters in the series are awful in the films. And that just, it just, one being Ginny Weasley, which, I mean, just don't even get me started. But there's not much you can do about it. They just didn't give her the attention she deserves. But of course, like, it wasn't extremely vital to the plot. So I guess I understand.
I think a big thing with Ginny now, after the discussion that Michael's been leading, and just now thinking about it all, Ginny didn't become really important till like end of 5, 6. And so it's kind of hard to, like, set her up for success.
And, I think, like, you know what I mean? She got very important, I think, honestly, in the beginning of Five. But I understand. Yeah, right. I understand. And I'm, like, not, like, I understand why Ginny wasn't reaching her full potential in the films. I'm not as upset about that. Even though she is my favorite character, and movie Ginny is, like, a pile of poo compared to...
Yeah, it's incomparable.
Yeah. And that's not Bonnie Wright's fault. Like, they just... I don't think they gave her anything to work with. But, honestly, Dumbledore. Guys, Dumbledore. And this goes over to Fantastic Beasts, because we have Dumbledore in Fantastic Beasts, too. And he is one of my all-time favorite characters. I love Dumbledore. Book Dumbledore... But the thing is, Book Dumbledore and Movie Dumbledore are completely different to me, not counting movies 1 and 2, when we had Richard Harris. And I don't know if it's all Michael Gambon's fault. So I do have to give some of this slack to Cloves, too, because I don't know what happened, but I feel like the writing of Dumbledore's character in the films changed after the actor changed. And maybe he was writing it more for Michael Gambon's interpretation of the character, but... I do not think that he gave Dumbledore the justice, or he didn't feel the character or portray the character truly in the films. And that is that worries me a lot for Fantastic Beasts, because I'm already loving young Dumbledore. Jude Law's Dumbledore is great, and I don't want them to mess him up. I don't.
I think with, okay, so first of all, Ginny, I'm one of the few people who will say this, but I'm sorry, I don't think Bonnie Wright's a good actress. I don't mean that she's not a good person. I'm sure she's a lovely human being, and I know she's directing now, and I think that's super awesome that she's exploring other venues in film. Sorry, Bonnie Wright, I just don't think you were the best actress for Ginny. And
she's totally listening.
And I know she is. And, well, I know her fans are. And I think I've found that a lot of people in the fandom have decided without really much merit to just give her the out on that one. And I think there is a combo. There is an issue there that, yes, Ginny is poorly written. But I think that there has been evidence of poor writing being elevated by good acting. And the thing to keep in mind with the Potter films... And again, this is really exposed a lot in the behind-the-scenes material, is that actually the young actors were given a pretty fair amount of input into how they wanted to approach their characters, and certain actions they wanted to take to express their characters and how to best fit their characters. There's a lot of really neat input that was given to them when it was decided that they were mature enough to handle it, which is around Prisoner of Azkaban, because Cuarón decided to challenge them. And Yates continued that tradition. You can actually see it if you, again, explore the behind the scenes. Newell, Yates, and Cuarón all tried to kind of extend a hand to the younger actors to say, hey, this is kind of an opportunity where you're in training, so... why don't we see what you think about what we can do with this character? So I do think Bonnie Wright is actually fairly at fault for some things that happened to Ginny. If you want to know something she is indeed directly at fault for, it's that scene where she ties Harry's shoe in Half-Blood Prince, because her and Dan came up with that idea, and it's terrible.
Oh, but... God. Dan had something to do with that? Don't tell me that. I love Dan.
But Dumbledore, I think, is also another victim of that issue, and I think... Elaine, I think that you pointed to it exactly, which is that he's great in 1 and 2, and he's a little rocky from 4 onwards, and kind of inconsistent, actually, and I do think that's mainly Gambon. I think if you want to target Cloves, or at least personally the way that I target Cloves for criticism, the one that I often kind of eye, and again, this can't all be put on him, because essentially what Cloves does is write words on a page. How those mm-hmm. words are expressed and how those visuals are translated yeah. to film are not up to him. He is just hired to write words. And
yeah.
I think an important thing to keep in mind, like, but something that I do critique him for, and this is something that he did in tandem with Mike Newell, Goblet of Fire is a trash pile. And and it's a beautiful trash pile, but it's a trash pile because it decided to actually do something very bizarre, and it upended the structure of Goblet of Fire. Goblet of Fire, like the first 3 books, is a mystery. and it does not give you the answer until the end, and it pretty much plays out in the same pattern as the first three books, but with a longer, more played out mystery. Interestingly, what he did was he turned it into a thriller, and he actually did what Half-Blood Prince does, where he gave you the answer at the beginning of the movie, and so there's really nothing to invest in at that point, because he's like, yep, it's David Tennant. Look at David Tennant. He's right here. And that was a very bizarre choice, and I think he did it because it was such a complicated narrative, and there were so many red herring characters involved that he could not figure out a way to put them all in the movie. So he simplified it by saying, it's David Tennant. I'm not going to really do a mystery in the same way I'm going to do a thriller where you know it's him and you know that there's something wrong with Moody because I'm going to make it really obvious. So I think like that tends to be my critique of Cloves, is that sometimes he will upend the intricacy of Rowling's mystery to make it more easy to translate it to film. Because I do think the Potter books actually could have been translated better to film.
I think a lot of people would agree with you.
Yeah, I don't think that's a wrong or an incorrect assessment. I think there is probably somebody out there who could have pieced the mystery together a little bit better. But it's so easy to say that in hindsight now when we have all seven books and we can go back and be like, well, Cloves, you missed this, this, and this.
I don't think that all of the things that Cloves, I don't know, quote unquote, did wrong can be attributed to the fact that, like, he didn't have all the information, though. Like, there are things that he didn't do perfectly that we had no idea, like, that had nothing to do with things that would happen later on. It wasn't all attributed to things that needed future information.
No, you're right. There are things that he did wrong that were just wrong in the moment. And the tough thing with the Potter books is that while they are all part of an overarching longer seven book narrative, each book is also its own self-contained story. Theoretically, you could pick up one of the Harry Potter books, and because of the way that Rowling writes them, she gives you enough explanation that you could just, if you were that weirdo, read Goblet of Fire without having read the first three books and be like, oh, okay, well, I get what's going on here. That would be a lot harder to do with the movies. And it's because they're trying to be really self-contained, because they're trying to achieve the same thing for marketability.
Yeah.
But that's what I think causes them to stumble more than the books, is because they're trying so hard to be like, no, we're our own story. Don't worry about it. You can get it if you didn't watch the other ones, but also this makes no sense whatsoever. And you end up kind of alienating both audiences, because the audience who hasn't read Harry Potter is like, what happened? I think I'll just go read the book and figure this out. And the audience who read the book is like, well, that wasn't anything like the book. This isn't what I wanted. So I think maybe if you want to throw a critique at Cloves, that's probably the critique to throw at him, is that he unfortunately had to succumb to studio and marketing pressures, and therefore his movies are a bit clunky, if anything.
It's also how they essentially, and I don't know if this was just Cloves, so I'm using the elusive they here, they tried to get rid of Creature in 5. They were like, we don't need this random house elf that's just mean and in a bad mood the entire time. And she had to step in and be like, no, you gotta keep him, you gotta put him back in. You actually need him a little bit more than you probably did the first pass. So it's, you know, there are times where they try to get rid of stuff and she really does have to push and say, no, you gotta keep it. And
that's such a bizarre incident too, I think, because if you look at that particular example, what's so weird about it is that, no, they didn't need to keep Creature because he's useless in the movies. And really, you could probably have replaced him with something else to resolve that storyline, because he's in literally that one scene. And because you've cut Hermione's SPEW stuff, adding in Creature in part one doesn't do anything to properly link that story. So you could easily, so that's there, and there is a bit of that contentious thinking, I think, between Cloves and Rowling, is that Cloves is trying to trim the fat here and there, and so he's like, Creature's useless, I'm gonna trim him. And Rowling is just like, no, you need him. And then he gets to the end and he's like, but
why did I need him?
Need him. And I think that's maybe what could help here, because Rowling gave us an example of what happens if you put her writing very straightforward on film. You get Crimes of Grindelwald. Ta-da. And I think Cloves is the one to come in and say, there's a lot of fat that you can trim on this. Let's trim some of that. Because Crimes of Grindelwald is a great example of all of the things that Rowling normally does in her books that doesn't work on film. One of the biggest, I think, just hilariously illustrated by the poster, is there's too many characters. There's like 20 characters. Right. And you have just over 2 hours to make the audience invested in all of them. And
she achieved it with Leeta, though.
That depends on who you ask. I've heard many people who are like, I didn't give a crap about Leeta.
Oh, and, I loved her.
Or who was that girl? Like, personally, I liked Leeta, but, and I think a lot of that actually was attributable to Zoe, because I think that Zoe, I think Zoe's a great example of actually taking something that could have been really bad and making it better than what it was. But that's what the issue with Grindelwald is as a script, is that there's too much going on. And in book form, yeah, she could throw all those characters in and she'd have the time to develop all of them. But in 2.5 hours, she dumped a bunch of characters on top of us when we already had characters that she got us emotionally invested in. And then on top of that, the movie has a war with itself about what it really wants to be about. If y'all recall, before Crimes of Grindelwald came out, Warner Brothers very brashly announced that Newt wasn't going to really be in the movie that much.
Right.
And that it was going to be more about Dumbledore and Grindelwald. And then the fans were like, we don't want that. And they were like, oh, that's what we thought you wanted. Well, okay, we'll go back and it's fine. They'll still be in it. And so then now you have pretty much two separate movies that are just butting heads with each other throughout the whole thing. I listened back to our post Grindelwald discussion, and one of the things that I identify, like I personally feel I like, is the structure of the movie is that there are four groups of characters, and that Newt and his group are the least important, and the film hates them and it wants them out of the way because they're just so hard to integrate into this narrative that isn't about them anymore. They are pawns in the narrative.
So do you think with Cloves being able to trim the fat, he'll be able to do that if she doesn't give him the whole story up front? Because there's still 3 more films and he's only tied right now to this one. So there's not necessarily any reason that she needs to lay out the whole grandmaster plan for him, right? So if she essentially walks up to his theoretical desk and like slaps the screenplay and says, okay, off you go, and then he tries to start taking things out and she keeps pointing, being like, but that's important, that's important, that's important, and she doesn't give reason, are we just gonna end up in the same spot that we were in?
I think that's a good point. I think that getting him signed on to do the last two would be probably be pretty helpful,
because then at least it would be a cohesive writing team. Yeah. For this last half.
I don't think there's any reason for her to not set the entire roadmap in front of him. I think she will.
Okay.
Because, and this is something, again, that you can really see if you look into that behind-the-scenes stuff. They have a really good relationship. Like, Cloves and Rowling really like and respect each other.
He called her his best friend, which, first of all, I'm jealous that he gets to be best friends with her.
Yeah, they're really... they're really close, and I think that because there is much less concern about information leaking than there was back in the day with the books. Like, you know, there were a lot of people who had to be somewhat in the know of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, that's not really the situation anymore. I think she can give him everything she needs to give him, and he can successfully use that. My only concern at this point is that, and this goes back to the other video I referenced, the Nerd Writers Epidemic of Passable Movies, because basically the thrust of that video is that we live in an era of passable films. And the reason we live in an era of passable films is because rather than do the work to create a good movie, studios, because they have to churn out so many movies in a year, will create passable movies or movies that are essentially full of cliches and that are built upon recognizable scenes, imagery, dialogue from other movies, because we as moviegoers are seasoned enough now to go see a movie and see a scene and be like, oh, I know the feelings I should be feeling as an audience member because I've seen a scene like this before. And it often means that the movie's not working very hard to get you, the audience, to that emotional understanding because it just cheated and copied from somewhere else.
Yeah, it's not working like to make an authentic reaction. It's kind of like a reaction that they made in a lab that is like it's like instant coffee reaction.
Yes, you know, actually a great example of that is go watch literally every current Disney live action remake. Those movies are so much that they don't have to try because they are just like nostalgic imagery, cliche. You already know this movie, so you're just going to watch it again and feel the same thing, supposedly. Or at least you're going to pay money to hope that you feel that way. And if you go and look at the first Fantastic Beasts movie, I think you will actually find that there are a lot of cliches in that movie. Like, and that's kind of why the movie is passable for me. It's enjoyable and it's fun, but actually it relies on a lot of plot cliches. There's not much that's new in Fantastic Beasts. In fact, a lot of people in their critical reviews compared it to the Goosebumps movie because it's the same plot.
No, I need to go watch the Goosebumps movie.
He's like, no, you don't.
Just go watch Fantastic Beasts. You'll get the gist.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, and there's, it's not like it's ever been, never been done before, the whole, like, oh, we gotta go catch, something's escaped, we gotta go catch it, movie. Mm-hmm. That's a plot. That's the very typical plot. The, oh, somebody isn't who they say they are plot. The, you know, the romantic subplot of Tina and Newt, of comic misunderstanding and kind of not liking each other at first. It was almost so cliche that we almost had thank God that was cut. Those scenes where Jacob had a girlfriend that looked exactly like Queenie,
right,
before he met Queenie. Like, that's pretty typical.
Wait, so I have a question for you then, Michael. Do you think that the Harry Potter movies that Steve Kloves worked on originally fall prey to any of those, or do you think that it's not possible for them to have because there was all the source material to work with?
Oh, they definitely fall to cliches. I think that's where Steve Kloves will can sometimes take shortcuts with Potter when it gets difficult. I think with that challenge of, oh my gosh, I have so many things to put on screen. How do I cut this down for an audience that may not know this book? So he'll do it in a cliche. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that not all cliches are bad. Like, cliches can actually be a good thing if you really need to shortcut something that's
they're overused for a reason, basically.
Yes, yes. There's things can be so hard to translate onto film sometimes that maybe you don't have an alternative other than a cliche. Leaning on other movies that came before you is not a bad thing. It depends on how tastefully you use that. And I think in some cases the Potter movies do tastefully use it, or logically use it to get past a point that might otherwise be a little bit sticky or difficult to deal with or longer in the book. But sometimes, yes, I think they fail. And in some cases, the Potter movies, I think, did that and failed. But because we're just talking about two separate beasts, so to speak, with an adaptation versus an original story, I think that's where the difference lies in what we have to see what Kloves will do. But Lizzie, I think you had more Kloves quotes that I'm interested to hear too about his process.
Yeah, because I think this next one nicely transitions into a larger question of, is Kloves the person we really need to be worried about, or is it bum 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 Yeats.
Mm-hmm. I'm always worried about Yeats. I'm in a constant state of worry about Yeats.
So the LA Times article, it came out before Half-Blood Prince was released into theaters. So the question was, I've also read that most of Dumbledore's pensive memories of young Voldemort, then Tom Riddle, have been cut from the film, not to mention Dumbledore's funeral.
Before you answer that, though, I just want to say that is, like, the best parts of Half-Blood Prince, and it made me really sad that they were...
I agree.
That's my favorite book. Anyway, sorry.
Yes. And I have to say, thank goodness for this interview, because it's redeemed Cloves a bit for me, now that, like, I'm finally opening my eyes and just, like, doing some research into who made these decisions.
This is very exciting for me to see, because I feel like it fuels a lot of things I've tried to explain to people over the years. So go on. Put it out there to the public.
So we're going to spill the tea.
Cloves literally basically said, this is not my fault. It is Yeats. He said, in my original draft, I had every single memory but one, I believe. I even dramatized a couple of things that weren't in the book in terms of Voldemort, like the death of Tom's parents, things like that. I'm a Harry Potter fan, so my first drafts tend to reflect that, in that they tend to be long and all-inclusive. When director David Yates came in, he had a very specific point of view, which was that he wanted to showcase Voldemort's rise without getting overly involved with his past as Riddle. He didn't think that most of the memories would be as compelling on screen as they were on the page. He liked them in the script, but he really felt that in the movie experience, Voldemort's story was more important than young Riddle's. We went back and forth on that for quite a bit, but he was very convincing, and I think it wound up working out well.
Okay, well, now I don't trust his judgment if he thinks that it worked out well, but whatever.
I was going to say, everything about that is, like, beautiful music up until that last, like,
yeah.
Well, but, remember, too, he is on a PR like he's not allowed to be like, and I thought it was terrible. That's like, if he wants to keep his job and keep
basically Yates took the entire, like, backbone of the entire Half-Blood Prince story and was like, not necessary.
Yeah, and apparently it was Clove's idea to add that little before Snape goes up to confront Dumbledore, before, you know, he has to murder him and all that, it was his idea to add that little shh that he gives to Harry, as so that you would be able to look back and call back to that for Deathly Hallows, which is very interesting. So, like, that was almost him, you know, really trying to pay attention to the source material and what these characters are really going through and give that little callback.
That was a great...
So
I'm one of the few people who really likes that fix, because the book version is that Dumbledore, that Harry puts the cloak on, and that Dumbledore puts a freezing charm on Harry so he can't move, and then Harry can't act based on that. And
I really wish that was in the films.
But that would be really hard to translate to film, I think.
I think
it's hard for, I think, people to take that moment, because Harry theoretically does not trust Snape enough to follow his direction, but that it's too different from how Harry would behave as the Harry we know. But I think it is important to see the distinction between book Harry and movie Harry in that particular instance. That is where the two diverge, and I think Cloves did such a good job of trying to really communicate, and in my opinion, for once, Gambon got the performance correct, that Dumbledore impressed on Harry that he really needed to go down and be quiet and not get involved. And then add on top of that Snape scene, when Harry has just heard from Dumbledore that he trusts Snape explicitly, and that Dumbledore insists on getting Snape, and that even though Harry has doubts, he trusts Dumbledore. And then Snape shows up, and really it's the only hope he has in that situation, because he's outnumbered. And so that scene, by adding that scene, Cloves is trying to fix the situation and translate something to you, the audience, that is easier to communicate. It's an example of a cliche, where he did a fix that was an easy fix to get you to understand something a lot quicker than having Dumbledore Petrificus Totalis Harry with nonverbal magic.
it also so beautifully and so simply plants that seed of doubt mm-hmm. for the movie viewer.
Yeah.
Of, wait, why would Snape tell him to be quiet
mm-hmm.
if he was going to do that? That doesn't make any sense. Like, what? That's so out of character. This, what does that mean? And it's just so simple and so just like chef's kiss, essentially, for a casual movie viewer to just see that one little thing and go, that feels weird. Why would he have done that? There must be more to this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I think that it's a great example of how he tried to fix something where he could. And I do think this is also a great example of how much a director can be involved in changing a look for a film, and why as audience members tend to attribute a film's result more to the director than we do the screenwriter.
Oh yeah, I probably blame Yates more for the murder of Dumbledore's character than I do Cloves, but I have to give, you know, everybody their credit.
Their just desserts.
Yes. Honestly though, like my fantasy, like knowing that Cloves tried to put all of that in, and that it was just,
it restores some faith in
me. And like my fantasy for these Fantastic Beasts films is that J.K. Rowling actually has like novels written out for these, and she actually just like has it all written out in a novel form and just hands it to Cloves and is just like, this is all of the material you need to tell the story, and then he will try to include all of it, but then Yates will come in and cut really important things out, like in freaking Crimes of Grindelwald, when he completely cuts out the part of that beast hunter's name. Like, we didn't know anything about that beast hunter.
Literally!
And I think that's literally all Yates's fault, because it's in the screenplay, but we have no context. Oh, that was in the first Fantastic Beasts, not Crimes of Grindelwald, right? Am I crazy?
No, you are right.
It is Crimes of Grindelwald. Okay. So
they just introduce you to this character with no context of what the character is, except that Newt does not like him.
Yeah, I'm like, well, like, who is this guy?
That's all you get.
Like, why am I supposed to care about him?
That's all you have.
So, you know, maybe Cloves will come in, do a great job writing a screenplay, and then Yates will come in and mess it all up. Who knows? We'll see. But hopefully he will at least redeem it enough that Yates can't mess it up too much.
There is a long storied traditional history in film of things almost being very, very much ruined by both producers and directors. There are many iconic scenes that we have in film now that almost ended up on the cutting room floor because of a bad decision somebody almost made. Popular examples include the MGM execs did not like the idea of Judy Garland singing in a barnyard, and so they almost cut Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And
wow.
The songwriters lobbied hard to get that put back in. But we almost lost Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And that would have been lost to time, because they did not preserve things that were left over in film back in the 30s. We almost lost Part of Your World from The Little Mermaid, because Jeffrey Katzenberg did not think that it was a particularly necessary song that drove the story forward. He thought it stopped the movie dead in its tracks and thought it was pointless.
This is why we have a system of checks and balances, both in politics and in theater.
Well, and that's the kind of interesting thing about this scenario here, too, is that Cloves is not just a screenwriter. He's a producer. He actually has a mm-hmm. monetary investment in this film. And so that gives him some additional say that a screenwriter normally would not have. In that position.
And so more of a, I think more of a personal investment to make a good film then, I think, as well.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Cloves is in the background running, throwing up his sleeves, and he's like, y'all messing with my money. I'm coming in. I'm going to fix this myself. If you can't trust someone to do it, you can only trust yourself. I'm coming.
Move over. I'm taking over.
Daddy's home.
I mean, I love the thought. I love the idea too, that, and the piece that he really stresses that he's a fan of Harry Potter. I feel like I trust him more with that than say the other person who said that, which was Jack Thorne, and who was just like, I know Harry Potter back to front. And boy, any interview you check with John, like, and about Jack Thorne, like, any of the other people who worked on Cursed Child are just like, Jack is just, like, the biggest Harry Potter fan. Like, he knows it back to front. And I was like, well, then what happened, sir? So,
this is what happens when you let Harry Potter fans write canon Harry Potter material.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's not too far. It's funny because I always feared this would happen, that this day would come. But it is, in fact, finally time, I think, to surrender to the fact that, yes, Harry Potter in many ways is actually going the same way as Star Wars. And that's, I think, and Star Wars, I think the thing to keep in mind with Star Wars is that Star Wars has a much longer period of time that it has had to experience what it's gone through. But, and I think its creator had a little bit, actually a lot more vitriol for it than Rowling has for Harry Potter. But a similar thing happened where eventually this world got way bigger than Lucas intended it to. And while Rowling, I think, made Harry Potter a big world, she was very much, if you go back after Deathly Hallows finished, like, all of her interviews, she's like, never say never, but never, I'm done. Like, she's done. Like, she's so done.
That's why I was so shocked that Fantastic Beasts ever even became a thing.
Well, and as we've, you know, talked about before on the show, Fantastic Beasts was something that she was partially pressured into doing. And and I think part of that came from the fact that she has, like Lucas, a very complicated relationship with her creation, and that she wants to move on from it and do other things, which I think is very clearly evidenced in the fact that she's like, I'm gonna go write adult mysteries now and, like, political thrillers. And yet when people threaten to take on her work on their own without her, she's like, no, my baby, I already know what's gonna happen with that part of my baby, please don't do that. And insists on being a part of that creative process. So she wants to remove herself from it, but at the same time, the Potter machine has to keep on chugging. And eventually, and it's weird to think and it's terrible to think about, but like with Lucas, one day it will chug on without her. And Lucas made the decision to actively stop being a part of that in his lifetime. I don't know if that'll happen to Rowling, but if it doesn't, she's going to be tied to Potter until her dying days because of Warner Brothers. They need to keep this franchise alive, and they want it to be as successful and have as much longevity as Star Wars. And that's why they got so scared when the first critical pannings happened of a Potter material that was really surefire and they had a lot of money on. Yeah. And I think Cloves is, I think, a great place to start. I mean, I have also advocated in the past that, yes, they should get a different director, because
recasting Grindelwald wouldn't hurt either, but that's a different...
Oh, that, I mean, I think at this point, it's they dug their heels in such an absurd way that ship has sailed.
Right.
Like, that kind of, like, that became so much of a thing that we're kind of stuck with it now, which I'm not happy about, but we got.
No, there's an out. We just have him
transform. He takes his face off again.
No, we just have him transform back to Graves and say, you know, I prefer this form more. I'm just going to be him for the rest of my
forever.
Life. And we just get Colin Farrell back, please.
This guy was actually a lot better looking and got a lot more things done. Yeah. So I'm going to just stay as him.
I think it would work. I would accept it without question if they did that in the next film.
But I mean, that's kind of why, like, it was funny to me when people were... There were whispers before the first Fantastic Beasts film came out that Cuarón was interested and that he had been in talks. Hmm. And a bunch of people were like, no, not Cuarón, he ruins everything. And I was like,
it's not true.
Like, even if you think that, even if you think Cuarón is a terrible filmmaker, which there's a lot out of evidence out there to disagree with that assessment.
Yes.
But and we as a fandom should feel so lucky that an auteur like Cuarón wants to still be involved with Harry Potter. Like,
agreed.
It's a big disappointment that he's not. But I think a thing to keep in mind is, just like what we were talking about with Cloves, Cuarón would not be working with an adaptation. He'd be working with original material. And in fact, right. I think that would be great fodder.
Yeah,
I think that would be great fodder for a director like him, or another director with that kind of visionary filmmaking sense like him, because this would be an opportunity to play in the Potterverse with filmmaking techniques that
I think isn't really doing. I think he would get a lot less criticism than he did during Prisoner of Azkaban for it, mm-hmm. because I think a lot of the changes that he made in Prisoner of Azkaban were, well, most of them were visual, but a lot of them were good changes. And I don't think that a lot of people would have criticized them as much as they had if there wasn't a source material to go off of. I think that if he got to play around in the Potter world without something that the fans were already expecting, I think that people would actually like it, because they wouldn't have anything to compare it to and say, this isn't exactly what we were expecting, so we don't like it. And I think that's where, mm-hmm. that's what Prisoner of Azkaban fell prey to. I think people didn't like it because it wasn't what they were expecting. But if you look at it from a completely different point of view, you're like, yeah, this wasn't exactly how she described it in the book, but it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really great, actually, conclusion to come to in this discussion, is that the screenwriter can only fix so much. And I think Cloves will help. I think Cloves is, I think he's done as much as he can to prove himself and endear himself, both to the fandom and to Rowling. But in the end, like you both have already said, Yates can come in and do as he pleases with that finished script. And I think from his track record, we've seen that Yates has solidified his filmmaking style for Harry Potter after a wild ride of inconsistency. And it's, I think, a big piece of what affects Crimes of Grindelwald's final result, because for all of the nonsense that J.K. Rowling may toss into the screenplay, it's up to Yates to help us understand that visually, and I don't think he succeeded.
Yeah. So, should we move on to the Newt case?
Before we do, I just want to give a quick shout out to Star Wars Rise of Skywalker coming out the week that this episode releases.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hope everyone enjoys, and may the Force be with you always. Man. Because now we both share that line. We both share always.
That's right. Since,
I don't know when, but now we do. So put it on your wedding case, because now it fits in two fandoms if you really want to.
Listeners, if you want to keep getting into it with me about directors, we can go into a whole thing about Rian Johnson versus J.J. Abrams over on my Twitter.
Oh, no. Oh, I want to hear. I'm going to have to follow your threads there. I need to know your thoughts.
Surprise. Rian Johnson is the good director. Oh.
Don't give away too much.
But now you want to hear why JJ is the bad one.
True. Intrigue. Mystery.
And the JJ fans just want to argue with me, so come at me, bro.
All right, so
shall we?
Let's move into Newt case. This week we're going to be talking about the augury, which is also known as the Irish Phoenix, also seen in Crimes of Grindelwald. One of my favorite parts of Crimes of Grindelwald, when we get to see Jacob meet the augury in Newt's basement. I thought that was really cute. So I'm going to read the passage here about the augury in the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them textbook. It is a MOM classification of XX, meaning harmless and may be domesticated. It says, the augury is a native of Britain and Ireland, though sometimes found elsewhere in Northern Europe. A thin and mournful-looking bird, somewhat like a small and underfed vulture in appearance, the augury is greenish-black. It is intensely shy, nests in brambles and thorn, eats large insects and fairies, flies only in heavy rain, and otherwise remains hidden in its tear-shaped nest. The augury has a distinctive low and throbbing cry, which was once believed to foretell death. Wizards avoided augury nests for fear of hearing that heart-rending sound, and more than one wizard is believed to have suffered a heart attack on passing a thicket and hearing an unseen augury wail. A footnote At that part reads that Yurik the Oddball is known to have slept in a room containing no fewer than 50 pet auguries. During one particularly wet winter, Yurik became convinced by the moaning of his auguries that he had died and was now a ghost. His subsequent attempts to walk through the walls of his house resulted in what his biographer, Rodolphus Pittemann, describes as a concussion of 10 days' duration. Patient research eventually revealed, however, that the augury merely sings at the approach of rain. Another footnote here says that you should see Why I Didn't Die When the Augury Cried by Gulliver Pokeby, written in 1824, publisher Little Red Books, because the augury merely sings at the approach of rain, not omen of death. The augury has since enjoyed a vogue as a home weather forecaster, though many find its almost continual moaning during the winter months to be difficult to bear. Augury feathers are also useless as quills because they repel ink. So some interesting facts about auguries. The etymology of the name augury is a play on the word augury, just spelled the same, just without an E. It's A-U-G-U-R-Y. And I looked this up on Wikipedia. It was really interesting because augury is the practice from ancient Roman religion of interpreting omens from the observed flight of birds. So why am I not surprised that that is so spot on? J.K. Rowling done it again. Goodness. And bird calls have been used to foretell the future in many cultures. In the U.S., the yellow-billed cuckoo is known as the rain crow because it often calls on summer days before thunderstorms. So pretty similar to the augury, because the augury can tell when it's going to rain, basically. And then a big part, other than it being in Fantastic Beasts with Newt and Jacob.
yeah. It makes a really brief appearance, doesn't it? It's in Cursed Child. Or not Cursed Child, God, no.
It's not in Cursed Child.
It's in Crimes of Grindelwald.
yeah, it's in
Cursed Child. It has a name, doesn't it?
Its name is Patrick. Yeah. Patrick. Yes. In Crimes of Grindelwald. But no, it is in Cursed Child. Plays quite a big part in Cursed Child, actually.
Nope. It's in Cursed Child without actually being in Cursed Child.
Yeah, no, you don't actually ever see an augury in Cursed Child, but it's basically the most important Fantastic Beast you see or hear of in Cursed Child. I actually didn't know this until I was researching for this episode, but I had always wondered this, but that original Cursed Child logo, I never understood what it was. I never got it until today. I was like, oh, there's like a nest with wings and there's a kid sitting in it. Like, what the heck is this? I had friends, like, I'm like the resident, like, Harry Potter expert in my friend group, not surprisingly. And I had friends who would ask me, like, what the heck is this? And Cursed Child logo, like, what is it supposed to be? I'm like, I don't know. I've read the play, I've seen the play, I don't know what it is. But it is an augury nest with augury wings. So, like, in Fantastic Beasts, or in the book, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, it says that auguries make their nest out of brambles and thorns. And it is so the logo is a thorny, brambly nest. Death Eater Euphemia Rowell kept a black augury in a cage while Voldemort's daughter... Okay, sorry, this is spoilers for Cursed Child.
No.
If you haven't read it or seen it, spoiler alert for Cursed Child, I already ruined it. Death Eater Euphemia Rowell kept a black augury in a cage while Voldemort's daughter, Delphi, was growing up. This is the Death Eater that raised Delphi. And claimed that it cried because it knew that Delphi was going to meet a sticky end. But then Delphi decided later to adopt the creature as her symbol and got a tattoo of its wings on her neck. And in the play, she tells Albus and Scorpius that it reminds her that the future is mine to make. And so that's why in the alternative universe that is created when Albus and Scorpius, you know, mess everything up, a.k.a. the plot of Cursed Child, the alternative universe that is created where Voldemort won and Harry died, Delphi herself is known as the Augury when she takes over the Ministry of Magic. So, yeah, the Augury plays a huge part in Cursed Child. And to be honest, I completely forgot that it did.
Who's Delphi? That's how I feel about that one.
I think the weirdest... I noted this on back on Alohomora, but I thought it was so weird that Cursed Child chose the augury to represent what it did and took it so seriously as a concept, because the whole point of the augury, as you have just summarized, Elaine, yeah, from Fantastic Beasts, is it's a joke.
Yeah.
Like,
it doesn't actually, it's not an actual omen for death.
No, it's a funny thing. It's just funny. And it's like, clearly, like the way that Newt writes it in the book, it's clearly like a stupid kind of superstition thing that's kind of outdated by current wizard standards. Like, wizards now commonly know that auguries cry when it's about terrain. Like, that's not a surprise to anybody, I'm assuming, unless they're still holding on to that superstition the way they hold on to the Grimm superstition. But wizards do seem to love thinking that everything's trying to kill them.
True. I think that Trelawney would be a huge fan of this bird.
Oh yeah.
Why doesn't she own one?
She should. That would be something that would definitely be up her alley, now that you say that.
Well, you know, in my opinion, if auguries are a joke and it's the logo for Cursed Child, then I think it's perfectly placed.
Shots fired.
And before someone starts writing hate mail at me, I've seen it. It was an enjoyable play experience. I don't need to go back, except my mother has now decided that she wants to see it.
so you have to go back.
So eventually I have to go back. But your plot is dumb. I'm sorry.
I mean,
we're talking about Fantastic Beasts, so, you know, it's fine.
I will never get over the Trolley Witch. Like, even watching on stage, that it was still horrible.
She's a Fantastic Beast now.
Oh my gosh, we should talk about her in the next Fantastic Beasts movie. I want to learn about her.
What the F was that? Was this just...
Is there a name for what she is?
No, not as far as we know. She just...
Well, listeners, if you want to hear us discuss the Trolley Witch as our next new case, just, you know, write in.
I think, the interesting thing about, the concept of the Newt case now on Speak Beastie is kind of what... It's hard to kind of say, like, what these things would be used for in the plot now that the beasts aren't used in the plot. But
yeah.
But it's still fun
to do a deep dive into different Fantastic Beasts.
It is. It's kind of just like a shame, though, because it's like the cool thing about the Beast's book is that she very clearly outlined what the beasts are for.
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is, if you want to tie it back to the main discussion, I'm hopeful that maybe Cloves might recognize, like, hey, you wrote this book that these movies are vaguely based on, and you've already outlined what the rules are for these beasts and what they do. So maybe we should use those instead of just making stuff up all the time, because who on earth knew
a concept
that, like, the Niffler also has, like, gold dust tracking abilities? That's not a thing. But it is in the movie because he needed it to be to have a reason to take the cute Niffler along with you. So now I'm just hoping that he brings Patrick along for some reason, because he's like, you know, I really need to know when it's going to rain. So like, when it rains, Obscurials have to go outside. So I need an augury.
Because Obscurials could be defeated by rain.
Yes, that's their one weakness is rain. So he's got to have an augury to know when to go outside.
They need to know when it's going to rain so that they can put that memory stuff in the water again, and you can have another scene of that guy showering and forgetting all of this stuff he learned. But no, to your point, I think that the augury is a really good example of kind of how Crimes of Grindelwald failed a little bit, because they put this Fantastic Beast in the movie. They even make a Funko Pop of it for merchandise and sell it, but they don't talk about it at all. Like, if you hadn't read Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, separate from watching the movie, you would not know that auguries are the Irish Phoenix, or that they cry at the, you know, at the sign of rain, or that they used to be a deathly omen. Kind of like Thestrals, you know, like, you don't get to learn any of these things unless you actually do the research. they just see him and he makes a funny face and scares Jacob. That's all that he does. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would have loved for them to have included more. I think the augury is a really, really interesting beast. And personally, phoenixes are one of my all-time favorite fantastic beasts in the entire Potter series. And we're going to have a lot of phoenixes in Fantastic Beasts as well. I assume that phoenixes are going to play a big part.
Careful.
I assume it's going to play a big part, right? We see the reveal of, what we think might be Fox at the end of Crimes and Grindelwald, revealing himself to Aurelius to prove that he's a Dumbledore. So, I would love for them to have gone into that a bit more and maybe, shown the connection between these two types of creatures or, I don't know, something.
I mean, careful what you wish for, girl. Because before you know it, this film is just covered in phoenixes and you're like, why? And it's like, because everyone is a Dumbledore. The end.
And you're a Dumbledore, and you're a Dumbledore.
Look under your seats. Everyone has a phoenix under their seat.
You get a phoenix, and you get a phoenix.
And listeners, I think it's only fair for us to mention that since we are covering the augury, Shannon was supposed to be here today. Sadly, she is
dead. She's
not
dead.
She was so excited.
No, she's not dead.
She was so excited to talk.
Everyone's always dead. So Shannon,
fake news. She's not dead. It's fake news.
But you know for sure when that augury popped up in Crimes of Grindelwald, Shannon knew. Like, Shannon called that out real quick.
Y'all know she's sick and she's truly well and truly sick when she can't make it on for the augury. So
yeah,
we wish her well.
This happened on the last episode I was recording on too. She was supposed to host with us and then she got sick and we were like, we hope you feel better.
It happened on the last episode where she was dead again.
Yeah, she's died multiple times. I just actually feel better. Stop being sick. I hate that you're constantly sick and I want to be on an episode with you, Shannon. I'm begging you.
So that's it for this episode. Today's podcast question: what are your thoughts on Cloves coming on as a screenwriter for Fantastic Beasts 3? Will he struggle or strive with the fact that there's no source material, aka the novels, to work from? We'd love to hear from you, so drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And while you're on the internet, please feel free to leave us a review on iTunes, especially if you would really like us to cover the Trolley Witch for a new case. Leave us a review, let us know, and maybe we'll make it happen for you.
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at speakbeastie, Facebook at facebook.com/speakbeastie, Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com, and you can also support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/speakbeastie.
I'm Lizzie.
I'm Helene.
And I'm Michael. Case closed.